Today is March 9th, 2016, and this is episode number 350 of the Apple Context Machine, a podcast for the Mac Observer. I'm Jeff Gamet, managing editor at TMO.
And I'm Brian Chaffin, a simple marble in a complicated machine. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/ACM. And if you'd like to comment on or question anything about the show, shoot us a note at acm@macobserver.com.
Aren't we all just simple marbles in a complex machine?
Yeah, some of us are more simple than others.
Well, that's true. And some of us, we're like Mongo, only a pawn in the game of life. That's all right. There's people that got that reference, and they're all nodding right now.
Yeah, I'm nodding. I'm sad, but yeah. I'm nodding.
No, see... I think Mongo is a great character because he overcomes adversity.
Okay. And that's this week's Apple Context Machine.
If you have anything to comment on. Yeah. All right. So I take it you're not a big Blazing Saddles fan.
I am a... You know, I have a complicated relationship with Mel Brooks.
I'll accept that.
I have a complicated relationship. You know, the man's a genius, but at the same time, I find the humor to be a little lowbrow for me.
Some of his humor is definitely lowbrow. I will grant you that. And yes, he is brilliant. Speaking of Mel Brooks, did you hear that that Spaceballs 2 is very likely happening, finally?
Did not know.
Yeah. One of the things that was keeping it from becoming a reality was that Mel Brooks said unless Rick Moranis agreed to be in the movie, he wouldn't make it.
Why was Rick holding out?
I don't think it was so much that he was holding out. It's just that he really wasn't interested because he doesn't do a lot of acting anymore. He's very selective about what he does and, whatever, you know, there's been a lot of stuff that happened in his life and he's had a lot of adversity that he's had to deal with and he's been a fantastic dad and fantastic actor, and he's taken time for himself. And apparently whatever Mel Brooks has in mind for Spaceballs 2 is something that Rick Moranis is now interested in.
All right. Good to know.
Yeah.
Good to know. Speaking of Spaceballs,
mm-hmm.
The FBI.
Yeah, I think
so. Yes, you think?
No, I was going to make a joke about going to plaid speed, but go ahead.
I said on this here show, actually, may have been TDO, may have been both, and I think I said it with Chuck Joyner. I accused the FBI and the NSA of becoming lazy.
Yeah, I believe you said this on multiple shows.
I have, yeah. I said it on multiple shows. And really, that's unfair. And I also pointed this out, but I will point it out again. Very easy for me to say in the comfort of my office.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very easy for me to make such an accusation. But the reality is that having had, you know, roughly a week or so to think about it, especially after being triggered by something I read this week, what would be a lot more accurate and fair would be to say that they have become complacent.
I like your choice of words there, or choice of word. Yeah, I think complacent is probably a pretty accurate assessment.
And the underlying arguments still hold true, right? The ability to slurp up all of the information and sift through it looking for bad guys is super awesome when your job is to stop the bad guys.
Sure.
You want to maintain that ability because you've been able to do it, and it's just kind of like, you know, it's just like a superpower.
Actually, yeah, it is a lot like a superpower. But with great power comes great responsibility. Uncle Ben told Peter Parker that.
It's true, and it's actually, I think, one of those, like, massive truisms that have come out of the comic book world that and that's one we should particularly pay attention to.
Yes.
And what I believe that they lose sight of is, of course, the fact that when you have that kind of power, in this case, to slurp up things and look for bad guys,
mm-hmm.
you know, slurp up all the information and sift through it looking for the bad guys, it will inevitably be abused as the definition of bad guy and bad actions shifts, especially when you start feeling like when you're able to find the bad guys super easy, people mm-hmm. start forgetting about the fact that bad guys were doing stuff. So the natural tendency for those with this power is to come up with new reasons to continue using and having and using that power. Right. This is like human nature in action. So, you know, one of the things that we, the people, must be constantly on guard against is unreasonable expansion of government powers, especially when it comes to surveillance, because it's never going to go away once expanded. It's seldom going to go away, at the very least, once expanded.
Right. And it also tends to have the nasty side effect of turning the population into the enemy from the government's perspective.
Yeah, absolutely it does. Absolutely it does. And again, these things are like written into our DNA or something, because it always happens. It always happens. And that's one reason why we talk about this so much. It's one reason why we're so passionate about this issue. So, with this in mind, something has been bugging me about the FBI claiming, FBI Director Comey in this case, claiming that we're basically that they've never had a situation where they couldn't break into something legally, mm-hmm. right? Where empowered by a warrant, where, you know, a situation where they couldn't break in. You know, if there's a safe, they can break in, which actually isn't quite true, because there are safes set up to destroy the contents if you try to bypass
their security measures.
So that's actually not necessarily true. Actually, and that's just the thing. So NPR did a fact checking piece on the director's claims, and they actually rated them 99.9% accurate, those claims.
Okay.
But the mere fact that it's not 100%, in fact, means that the claim that it's unprecedented is incorrect. So one of the examples they found, and I didn't actually include this aspect in the piece I read about this, but one of the aspects they found was a case where someone tried to rob a store. The store owner shot the guy.
Okay.
But got away. Several blocks later, the police find someone with a bullet in his chest. Like, okay. Several blocks away, like, you know, just like, you know, a few minutes later.
Okay. I'm with you still.
And this was in the, I think this was in the 70s. I don't remember the specifics, but they needed to be able to get the bullet out to prove that it was the guy, because they wanted to match up the ballistics. Because if the bullet was fired from the gun of the store owner, then that's the guy who tried to break in. who tried to rob him.
Mm-hmm.
And they both had guns, by the way. I think there was firing on both sides.
Right. And if it's not the bullet from the shop owner, then you have two shootings that you're looking at now, because you have this, which could be unrelated to the attempted robbery.
Yeah, well, I mean, they knew it was the guy.
Right.
I mean, you know, come on, it was the guy. But they needed to be able to prove it in a court of law.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond the shadow of a doubt. Beyond a reasonable doubt, right?
No. You have reasonable suspicion.
Yeah.
And you have beyond a reasonable doubt.
That's what I just said.
And
you corrected me.
Yes. And in the case of court, beyond reasonable doubt is what you're going for.
That's what I said, and you corrected me.
No, you switched to something else.
No, I said shadow, then I corrected myself to reasonable, and then you corrected me again.
Oh, sorry.
I'm just saying.
Well, what this proves is that I only half listen to you.
Well, that's probably about more, you know, half more than you should be. But anyway, so they got the guy. They wanted to be able to prove it. But his attorneys argued that forced surgery, because, of course, the guy doesn't want the bullet to come out to be matched.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And his attorneys argued that forced surgery is unreasonable search and seizure, violating his constitutional rights, because it's inside his body.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a place where the FBI hasn't been able to go with a warrant. They had a warrant, but they were unable to actually compel the surgery.
All right. That's very interesting.
Very interesting, right? So, again, not unprecedented.
Did the guy die?
Unprecedented. I don't know the specifics. And if I got any of those facts wrong, any of those, you know, loosely rendered facts, please, you know, write in and yell at us. ACM at MacObserver.com, or you can hit us on Twitter, at Context Machine.
Mm-hmm. You can leave comments in the show notes.
Yep, you can do that too. We appreciate all of those things, by the way.
We do.
So, again, not actually unprecedented. The FBI calls this unprecedented. But then there was a quote that NPR got out of Apple's attorney, one of its attorneys dealing with this FBI message, mm-hmm. Theodore Boutros.
Mm-hmm.
He said, do you mind if I quote?
I love it when you quote.
Quote, "For most of American history, there was a warrant-free zone regarding people's communication across the country. There weren't surveillance techniques. There weren't ways to capture what people were saying to each other. And so the government has become so used to having surveillance techniques, they forget this is a relatively new development."
Oh, see, that's fascinating.
Yeah, it sort of crystallized this complacency argument that I've been making when I was improperly and unfairly calling the CIA and the NSA lazy. When really they're being complacent. And Mr. Boutros is so right. I mean, he's really talking about this exact same thing that I've been going on about, which is that when you have this ability to get all of the information out there, you want to keep that ability.
Sure.
But you start relying on it.
Of course, human nature.
Yeah, you start relying on it because it's easy, and you want to keep that easy thing. You want to keep that awesome power. You want to keep doing this the easy way. And you know, we can go back to, and I can't remember if this started with the Clinton administration or the Bush administration. I can't remember which, but when as internet traffic picked up, mm-hmm. and the NSA was able to get more and more information, and the CIA was able to get more and more information by essentially getting it off the internet.
Mm-hmm.
We stopped having as many boots on the ground. Our country, and this is based on stuff that I read that I can't cite. Maybe Richard Clark's book, but I could be mistaken about that. Richard Clark being He was a longtime intelligence professional throughout multiple administrations until he told the Bush administration that Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with 9/11, and then he ended up, you know, being forced to resign.
Well, sure, because that isn't the intel they wanted. Now, right. By boots on the ground, you mean like spies, special agents, investigators.
Feet on the ground is a much better term, because boots on the ground usually means soldiers. Mm-hmm. Yeah, my mistake. Yeah, human assets, I believe, is what the intelligence world calls it. And I know all about this because I've read some thrillers here and there.
Oh, well, there you go. You were so qualified.
And for what it's worth, I've done a lot of reading. But, you know, feel free. I actually encourage you not to take my word on any of this and to do your own reading and your own fact checking. But the point is that one of the problems we ran into in the Middle East in the wake of 9/11 is that we no longer had the human assets that used to be the stock and trade of spy networks, because it was just so much easier and so much cheaper to slurp up information through communications networks, including including telecommunications and including the internet. And we're seeing a vestige of this now, where the FBI is just so desperate to be able to get backdoor access into things like our iPhones, you know, because it's easier than having to get information in other ways. And on top of that, we now put so much of our lives on these, you know, tiny devices that we carry with us everywhere. So much of our communication, so much of our relationships, so much of our networking, so much of our activities, you know, just more and more and more and more and more and more of what makes us are on our iPhones and our iPads and our, you know, our MacBooks and our Android devices. And, you know, for at least 5 or 10 people out there, Windows phone devices too.
I shouldn't laugh, because those people probably really appreciate that they were able to find a phone on sale.
The trains agree. So, can you hear the horns?
I did. I heard the horns. Okay. Yeah. I feel so forlorn. I feel like tying a little bag to the end of a stick and hopping in a boxcar, singing the blues, playing a harmonica.
To be fair, I call that Tuesday. So, let's see here.
I wondered where you were yesterday.
Exactly. I was hoboing it. Now, with that in mind, with all this stuff that we're talking about in mind, our reality is iPhones. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes it's easy to forget that iPhones were, you know, what iPhones were introduced 9 years ago now.
Has it really been that long? 2007. Yeah, so yeah, you're right.
I'm going to counter. Has it only been that long? Do you remember what it was like before iPhones? I mean, of course you do when you actually think about it, but we don't have cause to think about that on a daily basis. We just, you know, I mean, our iPhones are just, it's normal.
That's true. Yeah. Prior to my iPhone, I carried, well, actually my last phone before an iPhone was a Motorola Razr.
Ouch. Great. It was a great phone.
Mine kept breaking, but they kept replacing it, so it was fine. Yeah, I carried that. I had an iPod with me. I had a digital camera and a Palm. I carried a Palm PDA.
Sure, as one did.
Yeah.
But so my point is that, you know, this has become so normal for us so fast that when we hear the FBI saying, oh my goodness, we have to be able to get into these devices, you know, no matter how privacy friendly we are, for the vast majority of us, there is at least a little bit of inside of us that goes, oh yeah, you know, that's, well, you know, we've never been here before. just like the FBI says, they've never had a situation where you know they've been armed with a legal warrant and they can't get inside, they can't get the thing that they've got the warrant for, which again we know that that's not true, but there's at least part of us that has a sympathetic twinge to that notion and says, my goodness, their jobs are hard these days. You know, what's going to happen if they can't get into all our iPhones? Well, but here's the deal.
Mm-hmm.
This is a new thing. The precedent is not the FBI not being able to get into something. The precedent is the FBI and the NSA and the CIA, which the CIA is legally prohibited from operating within the United States, but the NSA is not.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The precedent is not these people not being able to get into our devices. The you know, 1 or 2 decade precedent is them having access to almost everything we say. That's the precedent. Because once upon a time, there were practical limitations on how we could be surveilled.
Yeah, that's true. And you don't have to go back that far in human history to a point where there was no way to monitor communications from people unless you were physically there.
Yeah, even with the development of the phone network, you know, which took multiple decades.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think by the time the 70s rolled around, everybody's got a phone.
Right.
But it's only in their house, and we're not walking around with them. You know, cell phones didn't become commonplace until the late 90s. Mid-90s, they start becoming a mainstream for sure.
Yes.
And by the late 90s, they're becoming commonplace, and we're talking about dumb phones.
Right. And at that point, if you had a cell phone, so a dumb phone style cell phone, you probably also had a landline.
You absolutely. Yeah. Well, the landlines start becoming increasingly. I mean, I think I don't know the numbers on this, but I would be shocked if a majority of households didn't still have a landline today. It's just more and more people are opting not to. Have you seen any numbers on that?
No, I haven't. But my guess is that the number of households that still have a physical landline is high, but dropping steadily.
If only we had a way of looking, right?
If only. Yeah.
Let's see what the Google says. Well, in this particular case, to be fair, we didn't really know. I had no idea we're going to bring up landlines.
That's true. And you know what? I'm going to use that excuse on every show moving forward.
More than 45% of children under the age of 18 lived in wireless-only homes in 2013, up from 2.5% in 2003. So in 2013, we're talking about 45% of children. That's actually going to be a subset of all the households.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I would imagine 61% of adults living in rented homes had no landline telephone. That's interesting. 27% of homeowners don't have landlines. There's a huge discrepancy there.
Now, the renters having a higher percentage of no landlines does not surprise me, because if you're a renter, there's a higher likelihood that you are moving more often. And
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. And then so the Chicago Tribune is reporting that 40%, we're going to have a link to this in the show notes, 40% of homes now without a landline. And this would have been for the second half of 2013. This is a 2014 report.
That's a higher percentage than I expected.
It is, especially going back, 3 years now?
Yes.
2 years. Two years, actually. 2 years and a couple months. So I wouldn't have expected it to be that high. But nonetheless, anyway, the point is that you know, most folks still have landlines. But even households with landlines that could be tapped, I mean, you know, that sort of thing used to be relatively uncommon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the FBI wasn't tapping everybody's phone. And then we had this, anyway, a above and beyond telephone communications, the bulk of our, let me rephrase that, the bulk of our communications were not on electronic devices until very recently, probably since the release of the iPhone.
Which is kind of fascinating that the change happened that quickly.
Yes, it is. And it's that nature, it's the nature of that change that is why that is at the heart of why we must in good conscience.
There you go.
I knew you'd get there. Resist the FBI wanting backdoors into our stuff because we were comfortable with the FBI having few legal limitations on surveilling us when the practical limitations made those legal limitations, when those practical limitations outweighed the legal limitations.
But now we have a flip-flop where the practical limitations are much lower.
The practical limitations are practically disappearing.
Hence, much lower.
Yeah.
So, to balance that out, we need to look at the legal limitations.
Yes. And that's what's so important about this fight between Apple and the FBI. Is it would not take much at this point to flip the switch on the United States and then the world becoming one giant police state.
That's a really scary thought.
It is a really scary thought. We are not that far. Of course, you know, predicting the future is perilous.
Yeah, especially without a TARDIS.
Yes. Well, the TARDIS allows you to see the future. That's not really predicting.
You know, this is one of the moments when I love your mostly pedantism.
Pedantry, I think, would be the
This is a new word.
The correct term. Well, my pedantry insists on you using the correct term, sir.
I just created a new correct term, sir.
I could push the OCD down. Push the OCD down. Push the OCD. Okay, so
I love doing
we?
That to
we
you.
Were talking. We were talking about something important.
We were pedantry. No,
no,
it was right before pedantry. I totally derailed
the police state. Flipping the switch on the police state.
Yes.
So, it is conceivable that even with the increasing amount of traffic happening over electronic devices, with more and more smart devices in our home that can be used to monitor us, right? You remember that Harvard study that we've talked about,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, all these devices with cameras and microphones and stuff could theoretically be harnessed by law enforcement and intelligence agencies to spy on us as well. Right. Despite the increasing amount of traffic related to that, it is conceivable that the government, our government, the Chinese government, the Russian government, any government could assemble enough hardware and software to monitor all things all the time.
That's totally plausible.
And it that point, we're not living in a free society. I happen to like living in a free society.
I like living in a free society as well. I understand and accept that there are dangers that go along with living in a free society. And some of those dangers are threats to me, threats to the people that are important to my life. But I think those threats are lower dangers overall compared to what we'd be facing if we end up in a police state.
Yes. And this seems an appropriate time to risk dipping our toes into politics. But it seems so weird to me that we're talking about sacrificing our security over iPhones over a terrorist incident, a terrorist attack that killed 14 people, when talking about the things that were actually used to kill those people is not being talked about. And that's guns. And it's just weird to me.
It is. Yeah, I've noticed that too. But if you look at the philosophy in the United States about firearms, I can see why that hasn't been part of the discussion. And that's a hot button issue that I'm betting politicians don't want to get into, especially when we're heading into a big election.
Yeah, it's true. I put this forth, though, as evidence that as a whole, our society is slightly insane, because this is not a rational, it's not a rational position to not be talking about guns, whether or not you believe in gun control or whether or not you believe that there should be no gun control, to not have that conversation in the wake of more and more incidents involving firearms whose purpose is to kill large quantities of people. It's irrational not to have that conversation. And instead, we're spending all this time arguing about smartphones, a smartphone that probably has. My feeling is that there's nothing on this smartphone, this iPhone, that's going to help the FBI find anything about anyone.
I think you're right. My guess is that at most, what they will find. No, actually, no. I think they've already found more through the phone records that were provided from Syed Farik's personal cell phone.
Well, and the cell phone records of this device too, because the FBI has that stuff. Now, don't get me wrong, because we don't know, there could be everything. All of the information could be on this one device. It's possible.
It is. It's highly unlikely, but yes, it is possible.
It is possible, and we don't know. And to be fair, to be completely fair, this is what the FBI Director Comey is arguing, is like, we don't know. And because we don't know, we need to know so that we can find it out, because our job is to investigate this. Now, I get that. But we're spending all of this effort, all of this enormous emotional effort and intellectual effort and, you know, the physical effort of talking and writing and reading about all this stuff on about limiting the safety and security of our phones, and yet we won't talk about guns. Doesn't make any sense to me.
No, it doesn't. But the FBI sure did pick an emotionally charged case, which makes sense because that serves their purpose.
Well, yeah. So my gut, listen, man, my knee-jerk response was like, and I probably said this, you know, they've been waiting for a case like this. It's the perfect case. Mm-hmm. Terrorist is dead. The phone is actually owned by a government agency, which has given us permission to, you know, for the FBI to do whatever they need to it. Mm-hmm. And it's a situation where 14 people in the United States were killed.
And 22 others seriously injured.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's this horrible, horrible situation. And, you know, there's no sympathy or empathy for the bad guys at all here. No one wants to protect their to protect their rights per se. You know, all of this argument is about the effect on the rest of our rights, mm-hmm. right? The rest of our ability to protect ourselves from the bad guys. That's our issue here. And so my knee-jerk response was that, you know, the FBI has just been drooling to have this case because this is the case they can get to get their back door, which is going to mess up everything. But let's be charitable and point out that this case would have become this situation whether or not the FBI was looking for a test case.
I agree. I think that the salt in the wound would not be there if there was a reasonable expectation that there would be valuable data recovered from that iPhone.
It's true. I actually, though, I very strongly believe that we need to reject whether or not the phone has anything on it as being pertinent to the case and pertinent to our freedoms.
I agree.
That whether or not the phone has anything or whether or not the phone doesn't have anything, it's completely irrelevant to the fact that we cannot have backdoors into encryption systems if we want to protect ourselves from criminals, other terrorists, and foreign agents out to steal our secrets and data and information and identity and bank accounts and everything else.
Yep. It goes back to protecting, in some cases, the actions of criminals by not being able to collect evidence to protect the majority's right to privacy.
And I prefer to, this is strictly semantics, but I prefer to look at the sort of the opposite way around, that it makes it harder for law enforcement to go after the bad guys is an unfortunate side effect of the reality of what it takes to protect ourselves from the good guys.
I like that. Yeah, I like that too.
Yeah. All righty. So, like, I don't want to delve too deep into this, but we haven't really talked about this cockamamie nonsense about how this phone could have a lying dormant cyber. How did he put it? It's a pathogen, but I can't remember what cyber word he used. Cyber, maybe it was just cyber pathogen.
Was it cyber pathogen or cyber virus? Something like that.
Yeah, lying dormant cyber pathogen from the San Bernardino district attorney that could be on this phone. I mean, what? Just a bunch of utter nonsense.
I can't even imagine what they're thinking by saying that. Well, actually, I can't imagine. It becomes a very emotional hot button and generates fear and uncertainty.
Yeah. The question, though, is this guy making this up, or is he genuinely afraid of this as a worst case scenario? I have no idea. I don't know the guy. I've only read his comments. I've not seen him speak, so I can't even do my poker player read on the dude, which, you know, you can decide for yourself how much value that would even have, even if I did do it, but I didn't. I mean, like, it's just nonsense. So what he's saying is that we have to be able to get on this into this phone because it could have a quote unquote lying dormant cyber pathogen. Unquote, sitting on the phone designed to wreak havoc with the San Bernardino County health computers.
Can you see me shaking my head?
Yeah, I can feel it. He said, quote, companies that introduce dangerous products, and it can be argued that the iPhone with its current encryption is dangerous to victims, are required to fix them. Companies that create environmental damage are required to clean it up. It's just talk about. I hope if this guy is elected, I hope he gets elected out of office at his soonest convenience.
It almost feels like, and yes, I'm totally speculating here, but it almost feels like after he saw the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing where they talked about encryption, and was it one of the congressmen that raised the hypothetical situation of an iPhone holding the location for nuclear weapons?
Yeah.
So I can imagine this district attorney saw that and was like, "Oh, that's brilliant. Okay, we have to come up with something like that, but it can't be the same thing. Cyber pathogen."
Yeah, I'm not gonna ascribe such. I won't ascribe such deliberate falsehoods. Most people come to crazy opinions through honest means, through honest methods, through honest process.
Which, of course, is totally reasonable. Nonetheless, it was a fun little speculation to toss out. Also, I got to create a little skit right there.
You did. It was a grand skit. Here's another quote from him. This was a county employee that murdered 14 people and injured 22. Did he use the county's infrastructure? Did he hack into that infrastructure? I don't know. In order for me to really put that issue to rest, there is one piece of evidence that would absolutely let us know that, and that would be the iPhone. Well, guess what, Mr. Ramos? Tough crap. You don't get to.
You know, and he's wrong, because if that iPhone was used to hack into other county resources, there would be other markers. There would be other bits of telltale evidence that they would find on their own servers, in their own logs.
What is the lying dormant cyber pathogen? Erase the logs.
So they don't. Then it's not so dormant now, is it?
Hey, man.
Hey, man.
It's a teaser for something that'll appear on my blog, geektales.com.
You're going to love it.
Maybe.
No, I'm telling people they're going to love it. Do you hear me, people? You're going to love it.
It'll be going up in the next day or so. Anyway, crazy, just nonsense. Let's talk about something joyful. We've had all this dark stuff. Let's talk about something joyful.
I like the idea of talking about something joyful. What do you have in mind?
How about the Wonder Garden machine?
That is joyful. That's exciting. That is so much fun. It's magical. It's wonderful. It's a happy place.
So you're saying it's marvelous?
It's marvelous.
It's wonderful?
It's wonderful.
I don't know the next line. So this is a machine created. This is not Mac related. It's not Apple related. It's just awesomeness and not personified. Well, the kid that did it is awesomeness personified.
Yeah, he probably uses an iPhone. There you go. Now it's Apple related.
He probably, yeah, that's true. There's a good chance it seems that he uses an iPhone, unless, of course, he actually rejects such modern constructs.
I'm thinking he doesn't.
Yeah, we have no idea. We should ask him. His name is Martin Mullen. He's a Swede. And he's created this machine called, that he calls Winter Garden. This is also the name of his band. It's WINTERGATAN. And this is, I guess this is called the Winter Garden Marble Machine. Well, that's what he named it, at least. And this, it's this steampunk machine. It's this all mechanical machine, mm-hmm. except for the fact that it's made out of wood instead of brass and copper. You know, looks like, you know, the sort of like the fantasy, like steampunk, the steampunk, the modern movement, you know,
yeah, like the most awesome steampunk calliope you can imagine.
Yeah. Or like, you know, it's a giant music box mm-hmm. that has to be operated in part by hand. And it's, you got to go watch it. First of all, we're going to have we have the link in the show notes.
Right. So you need to go watch that.
As a matter of fact, if you want to go and watch it before we talk about it, we're going to pause for, I don't know, what, 3 seconds?
Yeah.
We'll pause for 3 seconds.
We'll be here.
You put us on pause. You go watch the video. It's in the show notes. You probably also do a Google search for Winter Garden. Mm-hmm. And watch the video on YouTube of this machine in action. So let's we'll wait for 3 seconds and then we'll come back.
Okay. Okay, right, we're back.
We assume that you have seen it now.
Right.
And this thing it has 3,000 moving parts. It uses 2,000 marbles. It's got a flywheel and gearing and lots of mass and tubes and funnels to catch the marbles as they bounce around.
Also, it uses Lego. That's just so cool.
He does. Yeah, he uses, what are those called? What, pins?
Technic pins.
I think he calls them technique pins.
Well, he's also Swedish.
Yeah, right. And it's hand cranked. So he's got to actually crank this machine. And his cranking, He's turning a drive shaft that is turning a flywheel, and everything is geared. So the flywheel just, you know, the flywheel goes faster and faster and faster. But the speed at which he cranks, you and I haven't talked about this in our mini conversation. We've been going on nonstop about this.
We're a little obsessed by this.
A little obsessed. He's controlling the tempo of the music. So he's actually got to crank this thing steadily to keep the music steady. And while he's doing that, he's flipping these levers on and off that turn individual instrumentation on and off.
Right. It routes the steel marbles down different channels. It connects gears so that different instrument elements
are engaged.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then there's a belt. There's multiple belts that are they are programs. These belts have little.
That's where the Technic pins come into play.
Yeah, each row, each column represents a different instrument, and so by placing these pins on different rows and in different columns, he controls the rhythm, which instrument is being sounded, and the rhythm of that sounding. Right,
it's so really cool.
He's got one. So I'm counting the vibraphone. He's got a vibraphone here. It's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. It's 10 or 11 vibraphone. I'm a drummer.
Keys.
Those keys?
They are now
sold. Each one of those has a row. That's on one belt. And then he's got another belt for a kick drum and a snare drum. We'll talk about that in a second. And then he's got another belt where four columns bounce on the strings of a bass that he's grafted into this machine. And then he's tuned the bass to a particular to four particular. It's not tuned like a normal bass. It's an open tuning that he's specifically using. Mm-hmm. And then while he's cranking and turning these levers on and off, he's controlling the notes with his left hand like you would a normal bass, except for he's doing it the opposite direction that you would normally do it.
That's really cool.
It's beyond.
It's brilliant, is what it is.
It is brilliant. It is unadulterated artistic and mathematical and musical genius. And the song is good too.
Yeah, it is. It's yeah.
Yeah, I've watched it, I don't know, 20 times, and I've listened to it in the background another 10 times. Can't get enough of it.
Yeah, you've watched it more than I have, but I have watched it a few times, and it is really neat. And I kept watching, trying to figure out what was really there, meaning built into the machine, and was there anything that he was adding in, like maybe there was a ball dropping on a switch that triggered a sound loop that would then play.
Well, that's what I thought. One of the first many times, actually, until I watched. He has multiple videos for his process of building this machine, including two how it works. One where he talks about the instrumentation, and one where he actually talks about the mechanics of the marbles and how they're lifted and all that sort of stuff. And until I watched the how it works stuff, I quote unquote knew that the drum sounds, he's got a kick drum and he's got a snare drum, that those were samples, and that the marbles were, when they hit the pad that activated a lever, that lever was actually activating a sample, like, you know, that he had a drum machine bolted to the back of this thing, or a sample machine. Mm-hmm. Right. And that he had, you know, like, and I was actually like trying to in my head imagining how he would have hardwired the mechanical trigger that he built to activate the electronic trigger in the drum machine. But it turns out that's not what he did.
No, he invented elements that simulate the sound of the different drums. And he did it so well, we thought it was drum samples.
Yeah, so he's using, like, on the for the kick drum, he's using, actually, I guess he's using contact microphones for both. These are flat microphones that pick up sound much differently than, like, the microphones you and I are recording with right now.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then he's got, like, for the kick drum, I think it was a cork pad. And he's got that sitting on top of, directly touching the contact microphone. So when the marble falls and hits this pad, it's a microphone that is on this kick drum is picking up the contact microphone is picking up a thump sound, and it sounds like a kick drum. And then for the snare, he's doing something similar with a different pad. But then he uses basmati rice,
which is just brilliant
to give it that snare sound, to give it that sound that, you know, when we make drum sounds with our mouths, we go, or, you know, some kind of version of that. And he figured out how to do that with a tray full of basmati rice, dried rice attached to the activator arm that's being hit by a marble. I mean, come on, that's just crazy genius.
It really is. And I loved in the one demo video that I've seen part of, where he takes the rice out of the little tray arm and then plays it again, so you can hear the difference in sound with the basmati rice and without.
And it doesn't sound like a snare without.
No, it's just kind of this thud sound. But you put that rice in there, and all of a sudden it's a snare drum.
So all of the sounds are being created by acoustic mechanical means. Balls dropping on bass strings and his fingers. Some of the sounds are just the ball striking, but then some of the sounds are actually his fingers producing notes and rhythms with his left hand. But, you know, and the vibraphone is the marbles hitting the keys, which is not the right word,
and the hammers, and then
his turning motion with the crank. One of the things that he's turning is the vibraphone action that actually, you know, vibraphone goes like one 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 one. That's what a vibraphone does. Mm-hmm. It's a vibraphone is different from a bell, from a set of bells or a glockenspiel or a marimba, and that it has this mechanical thing that
vibrates. Wah 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 wah.
Yeah. It vibrates the sound, and then it's just the whole thing. It's just crazy. It's just crazy. I'm totally obsessed. Can you tell?
Nope, hadn't picked up on that.
No, I figured.
It's really cool. I'm glad everyone paused the show, went and watched the video, and came back so they can appreciate the enthusiasm that we both have for this.
That really just turned us off.
Well,
it seems possible.
It's possible. For the three of you that came back, thank you.
So, millions of people have seen this. If you're not one of them, please go and watch this. I haven't. No one that I've made watch this, and I've made lots of people watch this, has not been impressed. No matter their interest in music or steampunk. I mean, like, everybody is just impressed with what this young man has done.
It's really cool.
Yeah. So if you haven't watched it, go watch it. And, you know, and it was funny. I actually had two steampunk musical things this week, and the other one being the Candela Vibraphase.
Tell me about that.
So it is done by someone in the United States. It's a guitar pedal company. And they've made this. It's a guitar pedal, but it's not a pedal at all. It's because it's an elaborate machine. And there's a circuit that phases the sound. So you plug, you know, you plug your guitar into this device.
Okay.
And it's taking the sound and it's phasing it. But what he's done is he's put in these mechanical aspects that further affect the sound. And he's powering the whole thing with a candle. So the electronic circuit.
With a candle.
With a candle, a tea light candle. You know, this little thin, like a photo candle, but only, you know, 3/4 inch tall.
Mm-hmm.
Half an inch tall, thereabouts.
Yeah, little sort of tin tray that they sit in. Yeah.
And what I love is that the candle does two things. It, first of all, it creates electricity through photovoltaic cells.
Okay.
Solar cells.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So very, very tiny amount of power that's going through the circuit, because there is a circuit involved in here. And but it's also powering a Stirling engine.
No.
Yes. Stirling, and you're such a good straight man. A Stirling engine is a 200-year-old, it's actually 200 years old this year. It's a 200-year-old engine design mm-hmm. that uses two chambers, one for, with hot air and one with cool air, and then you get some energy created from the transference of air between the two chambers. At least I think that's how it works. I'm not an engineer.
Well, apparently, if that isn't how it works, you just invented a new engine.
Fair enough. But I think Stirling did it 200 years ago. And so the candle is heating the hot air portion of the Stirling engine. And the engine is self-contained so that it has a lifetime lubrication inside it. Like you don't have to oil this engine.
So really, all you need to do is get heat to it. And it works.
Yes. So the candle is lighting up that, and it's also providing power to the solar cells. And the Stirling engine is rotating a flywheel, is powering a flywheel.
Mm-hmm.
And then and then what that does is you can have you can actually make your own, but he's got a glass disc that has a pattern painted on it that interrupts the light from the candle to the photos, to the solar cells.
That's clever.
So as it rotates, it can vibrate. It's a vibrato, right? It can give vibrato to the sound. And by slowing that down or speeding it up, you control the amount of vibrato. So
okay.
The vibrato is being created by mechanical means.
That's really cool.
It is insanely cool. And then the way you control the speed is through a rare earth magnet. And it looks, it's just like he's got it in a ball at the end of this arm.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the arm is connected to the machine via a pivot. And by moving this rare earth magnet closer to a brass, a brass gear,
mm-hmm.
I think it was. Even though brass isn't magnetic, the magnetism from the rare earth magnet is so strong it creates resistance in the wheel. So you move the magnet closer and it slows down, and you pull the magnet, you rotate it down, and it speeds up. So that's how you control the speed of the vibrato, and it's just and it's gorgeous, and it's $5,900.
So if people are looking for a birthday present for Brian, Brian has simple tastes.
And so this man normally makes guitar pedals. That's what his company is. His company is called Z-Vex. His name is Zachary Vex. Get it? See what he did there? Z-Vex. And mm-hmm. And he's one of these boutique guitar fix people who specializes in making analog circuits. So they're circuits, but they're not digital circuits. They're analog circuits. So mm-hmm. Actually using, I think he's using some germanium chips, which were a thing back in the late 60s and early 70s.
Not to be confused with geranium chips, which are just dried up flour.
Correct.
Yeah.
That is true. And he told me that he's got 77 machine billable hours in the construction of the device. And of course that doesn't count the number of hours he spent inventing it and designing the circuit.
Mm-hmm.
So the $5,900 price tag is not because he's making $1 million on each one of them. It's just because it's a lot of work. But here's the thing I like the most about it. The sound is actually awesome. I don't
so it's
like
not a just a gimmicky thing.
It's not. I don't like. I've actually had one phase pedal that I liked, and it wasn't mine. It was owned by Joe, the leader of the Atomic Love Bombs, my old band. Mm-hmm. And so, unfortunately, I don't have any more because I gave it back when I left the band. That's the only phase pedal that I've ever liked. I don't like a lot of phase pedals; they just don't do it right. But this one sounds amazing. Just sounds glorious, and you can watch it in the video that I've got posted.
And we'll have a link in the show notes.
Right. That's what I meant.
I knew that's what you meant.
I knew you did.
Yeah. I was just offering up clarification.
Fair enough.
Yeah. You know what? I think that really was a fun way to wrap up our show and bring in something lighthearted as opposed to all the heavy stuff we've been talking about with security and encryption.
Yes.
Yeah. Hey, you know what? I should hit this button instead.
What?
And that's this week's Apple Context Machine. I need to fire the interns that don't know which button to press to make a sound happen. If you have anything to comment on, add a question, write us at acm@macobserver.com. And hey, thanks for listening, even though I don't know what buttons to push.
Yeah, that was like the worst cover ever. Worst recovery ever.
Well,
this wasn't their fault. This was all you, man. And our content is written by the good people at the Mac Observer. Our bandwidth is provided by Cashfly. The bass is by Boom, recorded just for TMO. And that's all for this week.
And stay subscribed.
Well, we'll see you online at the Mac Observer. Yeah, we could just delete that.
Like we always do. I was actually kind of worried what I was going to play next.